Hello, and welcome to your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Services Rochester Area Podcast. My name is Jan Heineman. Today I'll be reading to you from the Rochester Beacon. Our first story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Smriti Jacob and is dated November 3rd. Rochester Regional Health to expand access to genetic screening. Rochester Regional Health, today, that would be November 3rd, introduced GenoWell, a new community research initiative designed to help participants better understand their genetic health risks. GenoWell, that's spelled G-E-N-O, capital W-E-L-L, in partnership with Helix Research Network, offers no-cost DNA screening to help identify genetic risks for certain cancers and a cause of heart disease that can be missed without genetic testing, officials say. Helix partners with health systems nationwide to integrate genomic data into clinical care, aiming to improve patient outcomes and streamline operations. For us, GenoWell is deeply personal, says Richard Chip Davis, CEO of Rochester Regional Health. Rochester has always been a region of innovators, from the founding of Rochester General and St. Mary's to the breakthroughs we continue to deliver today. That's from Chip Davis, CEO of Rochester Regional Health. GenoWell hopes to reach more than 100,000 adults age 18 and older across the region. Participation in the program is voluntary, confidential, and does not require insurance. The screening is expected to provide deeper insight into inherited breast, ovarian, and colorectal cancers. High cholesterol is another inherited condition that can be screened for and assist participants in making informed and proactive decisions about their health. Sherry Nordberg, a GenoWell participant, says, "The benefit of learning that I carry a higher risk for something that I can take action on now to help prevent getting sick down the line means that I have more control over my future and watching my grandbabies grow." With GenoWell, Rochester Regional Health joins other health systems across North America that are part of Helix Research Network. This collaboration accelerates the integration of genetic information into everyday clinical care, expanding opportunities to bring novel clinical trials and research to local communities, officials say. Long before population health became a national priority, our system helped pioneer one of the country's first accountable care organizations, GRIPA, which set the stage for the proactive preventive care that GenoWell now advances, Davis says. Serving our communities with compassion and cutting-edge care is in our genes, and GenoWell brings that promise into the 21st century. That's from Chip Davis, COO of Rochester Regional Health. And this story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Smriti Jacob, who's also the Beacon's managing editor. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon, on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon is a guest opinion coming from reader Bob Coyne. Bob Coyne is executive director of Rochester Technology and Manufacturing Association, and Bob writes into the Beacon on November 5th, saying, "To win the AI race, we must not throttle manufacturing innovation." Bob Coyne writes, October was National Manufacturing Month, a reminder that we must not forget how crucial manufacturing is to our state's economy. It employs over 60,000 people in the Rochester area alone and over 12.7 million workers across New York. Fluid and dynamic, the industry constantly evolves as priorities shift, new markets emerge, and technology advances. It's no surprise, then, that artificial intelligence, a force transforming daily life and reshaping global competition, is now central to manufacturing's continued success. A 2024 survey found that 72% of manufacturers now use AI to reduce costs and improve operational efficiency. The technology is a powerful force multiplier, enabling businesses to develop products more quickly while maintaining the high quality expected of American-made goods. AI allows manufacturers to remain competitive and flexible as market demands continually shift. But just as manufacturers rely on artificial intelligence, AI innovation depends on manufacturing. Why? Manufacturers produce the semiconductors to power the chips that make AI possible. You can't have one without the other. If America wants to bolster AI, it must invest in manufacturers. The Rochester region has been selected to lead the charge as part of the New York Smart iCorridor Tech Hub, a collaboration that will help the Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse regions become global leaders in semiconductor manufacturing. Just last year, the hub received $40 million in funding from the U.S. Economic Development Administration to further strengthen our growing chip-making industry. We're attracting some of the nation's top talent for research, development, and workforce training. State Senator Jeremy Cooney echoed that sentiment, saying, "The New York Smart Eye Corridor sets not only our region, but surrounding upstate communities on a path to become a national and global leader in technology development." But that tech leadership faces increasingly stiff international competition. China, for instance, has invested nearly $100 billion to fund its own semiconductor industry and AI startups. American manufacturing has the advantage, but we can't get complacent. Fortifying our domestic chip supply and semiconductor development is necessary to maintain American leadership in technology and national security. It reduces our dependence on imports, allowing U.S. manufacturers to improve AI systems without potential foreign interference. Equally crucial is cultivating a pro-innovation regulatory environment. Operating in the U.S. is already expensive, a reality that has driven many manufacturers abroad. The more restrictive regulations enacted in Albany or Washington, the more business prospects we risk losing. And the more opportunities we miss, the more fragile our competitive edge becomes. Modern chip fabrication relies on AI for logistics, automation, and quality control. Excessive or inconsistent regulations that slow AI development impact every layer of the supply chain, making it harder for U.S. producers to compete globally. On the issue of AI regulations, the United States has reached a crossroads. All 50 states have introduced legislation to regulate the development of AI, totaling more than 1,100 bills. New York's RAISE Act, R-A-I-S-E, is one such example. Having passed both chambers of the state legislature, the bill now awaits Governor Kathy Hochul's approval. But state-level bills like this could create real challenges. Much of the legislation we've seen is unnecessary, as it addresses concerns already covered by strong state and federal laws. Worse, these bills would create a confusing and fragmented patchwork of AI regulation, which would complete a compliance nightmare that could deter technology and manufacturing companies from choosing New York and the U.S. as their home. The solution isn't a maze of conflicting regulations, nor is it an entirely hands-off approach. Instead, we need a unified federal framework, a set of clear, common-sense guardrails that encourage responsible innovation without stifling progress. Establishing consistent rules of the road would inspire economic growth, attract top tech talent, and strengthen domestic chip manufacturing. If we want to win the AI race, we must empower the sectors that make it possible. The U.S., with the Buffalo-Syracuse-Rochester region at its epicenter, can bolster its technological edge in the AI race. But we must invest in cutting-edge manufacturing, streamline our AI regulations, and produce the world's most advanced chips here at home. Manufacturing Month is more than an annual event. It's a call to action. This letter to the editor of the Rochester Beacon came from Bob Coyne, who is the executive director of Rochester Technology and Manufacturing Association. And the Beacon welcomes comments and letters from readers who adhere to our comment policy, including use of their full real name. You can respond to the Beacon at letters@rochesterbeacon.com. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writers Jacob Schirmerhorn and Narm Nathan and is dated November 6th. Evans highlights gains in public safety and pledges continued focus. Rochester Mayor Malik Evans, fresh off his re-election victory, touted declines in crime incidents, particularly shootings and car thefts, during a public safety press conference on Thursday. "Although I'm gratified by the numbers, I cannot be satisfied," he said at a press conference Thursday, a familiar refrain in his remarks on public safety. This follows a trend outlined by the Rochester Beacon this summer, which shows crime declining since its peak during a spike that began in 2021. Since then, incidents have dropped closer to their pre-COVID pandemic levels, especially violent crimes. For example, Rochester Police Department data indicates that there were 25 homicides from January to September. This is down from last year's total of 33 for the same period, and much lower than the heightened levels seen in 2021, 22, and 23, which had 54, 60, and 43 homicides, respectively. RPD data show the number of shooting victims is also closer to pre-COVID levels, with 112 non-fatal and 17 fatal victims through the third quarter of 2025. In 2019, those values were 109 non-fatal and 19 fatal victims. Also classified as a violent crime, robberies reached a record low during this time span, with 274 incidents through September. Evans says, "The stories behind the continued violence keeps me frustrated. What doesn't show up in the numbers is the incredible level of irrational behavior that goes hand in hand with gun violence. Combined with the continued presence of illegal guns, this continues to fuel this problem. And that's why we continue to investigate every shooting and non-fatal shooting with the same relentless focus on justice." Corporation Counsel Patrick Beeth reiterated the importance of the gun violence state of emergency for quick responses in these cases. "The state of emergency has been in place and renewed every month since 2022, granting the mayor the authority to quickly mobilize services from the RPD, the Office of Violence Prevention, and the Office of Recreation and Human Services." Beeth says, "When we think about victims of shootings, it's at those parties and party locations that get out of hand and turn into gun violence that we see more victims, because there are more people there. And so we don't have time to waste in those situations. And the mayor has to use the gun violence emergency order to shut those places down swiftly. Under state law, the mayor has broad authority to handle an emergency, but he chooses to use these emergency closure orders in a narrow and strategic way, just targeting those businesses that get out of hand and are prone to gun violence." Beeth said that the emergency closure for businesses is 5 days. The city has issued 7 closure orders since July. Firearm-related crime continues to be most concentrated in the city's northeast quadrant, particularly in the North Clinton neighborhood. Following the overall trends, incidents are lower in those areas than in previous years, however. More broadly, violent crime is most apparent in the Crescent neighborhoods directly outside the inner city. In addition, the eastern half of the inner city continues to have a higher proportion of violent incidents. This includes the Special East End Entertainment District, a special event zone that was designated by the mayor in 2024. The measure made the section a zone with age restrictions, the ability to limit types of traffic, and search bags. Since its inception, Evans has sung its praises in decreasing crime in the area, but some business owners have lamented the decrease in business and foot traffic. Property crimes decreased through the end of September. Incidents of larceny and particularly burglaries are at their lowest rate in RPD records, which date back to 2011. Motor vehicle thefts remain significantly higher than usual at 1,149, but they are much lower than the spike experienced in 2023, 3,280, and an improvement from last year, 1,538. Since that spike, Rochester became part of a lawsuit against Kia and Hyundai for their negligent security practices, with the manufacturers later offering free security software upgrades. RPD Chief David Smith said, "This decrease is due not only to prevention efforts among car manufacturers, public awareness efforts, but significant enforcement efforts continuing with our partnership with the state police in the Dove Project, which resulted in 215 arrests for stolen vehicles in the first 3 quarters of this year." The Dove initiative went into full effect this summer, with the Special Public Safety Detail partnering the RPD, New York State Police, and Monroe County Sheriff's Department, along with several suburban agencies. Smith has previously said that pooled resources include as many as 60 officers to assist in investigations and traffic stops, as well as ticket and warrant issuances. Property crime, which includes larceny, burglary, and motor vehicle theft, continues to be concentrated primarily in the eastern quadrant of the city, with the majority of incidents occurring in the East End and neighborhoods surrounding the University of Rochester. Motor vehicle crime is also concentrated in the East End, which typically has a lively nightlife and increased activity during peak crime hours. Smith also mentioned the statewide targeted reductions of intimate partner violence at the press conference. The program is a partnership between RPD, the District Attorney's Office, the Monroe County Office of Probation, the Monroe County Sheriff's Office, and the Willow Domestic Violence Center. The program has been operating for 6 months, supported by a $2 million grant. So far, it has identified a dozen specific high-risk situations in which a targeted, coordinated response was initiated, said Smith. He reported, at the last STRIVE meeting, that's Statewide Targeted Reductions of Intimate Partner Violence, I was informed that, again, RPD is leading the way statewide, and we are months ahead of other agencies initiating their STRIVE programs. Although in its infancy, this STRIVE program is continuing to grow and show positive results. In addition, STRIVE is in the process of hiring a civilian coordinator and civilian analyst with a detective assigned full-time to RPD's domestic violence investigation team soon, Smith announced. Warning tickets will be issued through the end of the year for violations captured by the new school bus stop arm cameras. The camera installation was confirmed by the Rochester City School District this summer and is part of the city's Vision Zero program, which aims to increase road safety. Beginning in January 2026, fines will be imposed, starting at $250 for the first offense and increasing by $25 for each subsequent violation, with a maximum of $300 per offense. Also in RCSD schools is an anti-violence organization called Pathways to Peace, which has been embedded in 9 schools this year, according to Zikwa Tooks, director of the Office of Violence Prevention. He said that OVP is looking to strengthen its approach to meet students where they are and engage more with families. OVP's Advance Peace program, which rehabilitates former gun offenders through an 18-month program of mentorship and cognitive behavior therapy, is entering its 4th cohort this year, said Tooks. The mayor said, going into my second term, we'll continue these same public safety briefings. We thought that it was important and imperative that we inform the public, the mayor said. This is an all-hands-on-deck approach as it relates to public safety. We have made great progress over the last 4 years. We look forward to making even more great progress over the next couple of years. This story from the Rochester Beacon came from writers Jacob Schermerhorn and Narm Nathan, and you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story is another guest opinion, a letter to the editor of the Rochester Beacon, Denny Wright's Journey into Darkness. This story comes from reader Mike Mazzio, who's a retired Rochester Police Department investigator. He served as the former president of the Rochester Police Locust Club for 16 years. Denny Wright's Journey into Darkness. 6 years ago, on October 4th, 2019, I was boarding a plane to Orlando, Florida for an executive board meeting of the National Association of Police Organizations. The plane was taxiing for takeoff when I received a text informing me that one of our Locust Club members had been injured on a call. It was described as a cutting or a stabbing. More information to follow. Of course, the additional details wouldn't come through until we landed. Denison Wright was a dedicated police officer whose life changed forever in a split second. What happened during that 911 call was covered extensively in the media. The unimaginable loss of sight suffered by an officer responding to a call so violently attacked and gravely wounded during a domestic disturbance call, generated widespread attention. When I arrived at the hotel hosting our board meeting, I began receiving updates. The news felt like a roller coaster. First, he was alive, but in a serious life-threatening condition, a relief that offered hope. Then came news that he had lost sight in one eye. Tragic, yes, but potentially manageable. I met with the NAPO president and informed him of what was unfolding back home. Our board has veteran police association leaders from across the country, a tight-knit group who support each other during crises. As the meeting was about to start, I received shocking news. The doctors had concluded that Denny had lost sight in both eyes. As the meeting opened, President Michael McHale, visibly emotional, shared this latest update. Everyone in the room took it hard. We all understood the challenges of supporting an officer through severe injury and recovery, but none of us had ever faced helping someone suddenly plunged into complete blindness after such a tragic attack. Officer Wright faced immediate challenges far beyond his job. Even basic tasks, moving around his home, cooking meals, recognizing people, required learning everything anew. He entered a new world from which recovery couldn't restore what was lost. I can't count how many members I've supported through long recoveries from disabling injuries. A common theme is enduring the slow pace of recovery systems, often moving slower than a broken clock's tick. Combine this grueling stress with losing your most relied upon sense, your sight, and you begin to understand Denny's struggle. Denny has found solace in the love and support of his family, friends, and fellow officers who've heard him speak as a survivor with an important message for his peers. Since that tragic day, he has learned new skills like horseback riding and skydiving. But there's one thing he hasn't mastered, how to deal with time. Imagine being told you must wait days for something to happen, not just dismissing the delay, but enduring agonizing minutes stretched into hours or even days while waiting in darkness. Denny continues challenging himself with new experiences every day to move forward. Unfortunately, many outside his world don't grasp the importance of reaching milestones or how difficult even simple approvals can be. For example, it took 2 weeks just to get permission for him to speak at recruit classes and other events. He is frustrated by how the city and department handle officer wellness. To quote Denny, "We know how to give an officer and their family a grand funeral, but we have no idea how to support an officer whose life is scarred by a totally disabling injury." That truth has stayed with me. Over the years, before retiring from the Locust Club, I met with local and state leaders to discuss how we could better respond to both mental illness in our communities and the wellness of officers who face trauma every day. When Daniel's Law, which is pending legislation introduced by Senator Samra Brooke and Assemblymember Harry Bronson after the death of Daniel Prude, when Daniel's Law was first being discussed, I tried to open dialogue about how to make reform meaningful on both sides, to improve responses to people in crisis, and to ensure that the officers answering those calls are supported too. Those conversations were difficult at a time of intense national scrutiny of policing, and many meaningful exchanges never happened. The pendulum had swung too far in one direction. At the same time, Denny's case exposed how unevenly we approach officer wellness. Leadership spoke often about the importance of mental health and recovery, yet when it came to specifics, the follow-through fell short. The city provided for a companion to help Denny with daily needs, a necessary and appreciated step, but what he needed most was purpose, the ability to contribute again. It took months before he was finally allowed to speak to recruits or to tell his story and help others learn from it. That delay, for a man who's already lost so much, was its own kind of injury. Denny also continues to face a long legal process tied to his injury, a case that has dragged on for years with adjournments and motions. His goal has never been financial gain. What drives him is the hope that one day medicine might offer a chance to regain even a trace of vision, and that the systems designed to protect those who protect others will not stand in the way. The delays, denials, and missed conversations all point to a larger issue. We have built systems that know how to mourn loss, but not how to sustain those who live with it. True reform, whether in policing, wellness, or community response, must include space for both accountability and compassion. This letter to the editor of the Rochester Beacon came from Mike Mazzio, who's a retired Rochester Police Department investigator. And as we said before, the Beacon does welcome comments and letters from readers who use their full real names in submitting their comments. You can write to the Beacon at letters@rochesterbeacon.com. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon is dated November 11th and comes from writer Will Cleveland. Will Cleveland and the Rochester Beacon have a partnership where Will Cleveland passes on articles which he has published on his Substack site, which is called Cleveland Prost. This time, Will Cleveland's writing about beer. Ellen Gooch's unlikely road to becoming Rochester's best brewer. Ellen Gooch readily admits she never expected to be brewing beer for a living. So there's no way she could have anticipated wearing the crown as Rochester's most popular brewer. But here we are. Gooch, a brewer at Strange Bird Beer, the city's most adventurous and acclaimed brewery, last year earned the City Magazine title, outpolling her bosses, Eric Salazar and Micah Krasinski, both Strange Bird co-founders and co-owners. Gooch has been nominated again and can defend her title with the help of her adoring fans. As Gooch tells it, she's Rochester's favorite brewer, not the best, because our scene is blessed with a lot of incredible talent. Voting is open till November 28th, and you can vote for Ellen and all your favorites at bestof.rockcitymag.com. That's the Best of Rochester voting, which you can do at rockcitymag.com. Back to the beer. In the face of shifting beer landscape, I thought it would be fun to kickstart the Prost Profiles series again. Expect to meet some of Rochester Region's most passionate and fascinating beer characters in future interviews. We're starting with Gooch, a 31-year-old Irondequoit native who has been brewing professionally for about 2 years now. Gooch has a great story, is a great person, and highlights all that is right about craft beer, creating an inclusive, inviting, and fun environment for all. Cleveland Prost asks, in interviewing Ellen Gooch, "Introduce yourself. Who are you? And how did we get here? Can you outline your meandering path to becoming a brewer?" Ellen Gooch responds, "How did we get here? I don't think I was ever into beer growing up. I wasn't really a big drinker. I didn't sneak stuff from my parents. I wasn't out in the field doing stuff I told my parents I wasn't doing. I went to school at SUNY Fredonia and studied business administration with a concentration in the music industry. And then I minored in communications. I wanted to be a tour manager. I was really into music at the time, and I'm very organized, and I like the detail kind of stuff. I thought it would be a fun thing. I graduated college, and I was part-time bartending. I moved into event planning at iSquare in Irondequoit, and starting in 2016, I started managing the conference center there, doing a lot of the private events and the food and wine pairings. And then they have the Reserve, the beer and wine bar on the first floor. And when they started up a craft beer club, they put me in charge of sending out all the pairing information and the beer information. I had a moment where I realized I liked doing that sort of thing better. I decided to leave my job at iSquare and take a shot at craft bartending. I sent out a post on my Instagram story one day asking if anyone knew of any breweries hiring, and the next week I started at K2 Brothers Brewing. That was in 2018. I was there full-time until the pandemic in 2020, learning about beer and enjoying being a young person in beer. After the pandemic, I moved from K2 to Iron Smoke, a brief foray into bourbon and whiskey. And then I've been here at Strange Bird since the day we opened in 2021. The interviewer asks, "So how did you make the transition into brewing?" Gooch responds, It wasn't something I anticipated at the time, but it was something I'd been kind of thinking about for a while. When I was still at the first brewery I worked at, I was hoping for some growth and maybe a back-end opportunity there. That never came to fruition. When the opportunity presented itself here as brewing assistant at Strange Bird, I wrote up a little cover letter, sent my resume in, and we did an interview, and I made the transition a couple of weeks later. The interviewer asks, "What were your main duties as a brewing assistant?" Gooch responds, "I started off doing readings on the beers as they fermented, logging all that information in the computer, just shadowing our head brewer at the time, Nikki Forster, with doing line setups and learning how to clean tanks. From there, I sped through." Cleveland Prost asks, "I know your official title is now brewer, so when did you drop the assistant part from your title?" Gooch says, "It was after a trip we took to Belgium in late 2023. There was another brewer from Pennsylvania on the trip who kind of degradingly referred to me as another female brewer as assistants. And when Micah and Eric heard that, they were like, yeah, we're not cool with that. We'll drop the assistant. Tell people you're a brewer because you are." I was like, okay. So I've been a brewer officially since then. It was an interesting experience. And the interviewer asks, "So how did you get nominated for Rochester's favorite brewer?" Gooch responds, "Before brewing, I was involved in front of house hospitality work. So I'd like to think I have a ton of people out in the industry still that I know by name, and I like to go get a drink at their bar. I got nominated because Micah told us all to nominate ourselves. He was like, you guys are all brewers. You should tell your families to nominate you. So I texted my mom and I told her my family should nominate me. When the list came out, I was a bit surprised. I was expecting to see some other names. There's so many experienced, wonderful brewers in this city. It's an honor. I hold the title with pride, but I do like to refer to it as Rochester's favorite brewer, not best brewer, because there's so many amazing brewers here." She says, "This is a great job. Keeps me physically active while also keeping my brain stimulated. There are lots of moving parts every day. There's a lot of problem solving and troubleshooting. It's also really cool to tell people that you make beer." That's Ellen Gooch, voted favorite brewer in Rochester. Ellen Gooch is at Strange Bird Brewery, and this story about her comes from Will Cleveland, who's a contributing writer to Democrat and Chronicle, a beer expert, and a former Democrat and Chronicle reporter. And you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio reading service. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Jacob Schermerhorn and is dated November 11th. DEC signs agreement with Greenidge, ends legal battle. Bitcoin mining company Greenidge Generation has reached an agreement with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation for an air permit at its site on the western shore of Seneca Lake. The move ends active litigation between the two parties. The agreement includes an emissions reduction of 44% for permitted greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, along with a mandate for a 25% reduction from Greenidge's actual emissions. It also requires the company to submit a permit modification application. A statement from the DEC reads, "The agreement holds Greenidge Generation accountable to new proposed permit conditions that are protective of the community and brings the Greenidge facility in line with greenhouse gas and co-pollutant emissions levels consistent with the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. Greenidge noted that its status as a quick dispatch power generator will aid the state's power grid amid increased electricity demand. The facility is a retrofitted natural gas-powered plant with a capacity of 106 to 108 megawatts. Greenidge took over the location in 2017 and began proof-of-work crypto mining in 2019. The company also has cryptocurrency facilities in Mississippi, North Dakota, and South Carolina. Greenidge President Dale Irwin said in a statement, "This new permit includes historic emissions reductions that go far beyond anything required by the CLCPA or ever implemented in New York, and validates our national model cryptocurrency operation, which does not pull power from the grid, but rather sends power to it daily." The local International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers also spoke in support of the decision. Greenidge's legal battle began in 2022 when the DEC denied its air permit for CLCPA non-compliance. Over the following 3 years and legal fights, Governor Kathy Hochul signed a temporary moratorium on crypto mining. At the time, local climate advocacy group Seneca Lake Guardian lauded her action and encouraged her to finish the job by shutting Greenidge Generation down completely. However, Greenidge was exempted from the moratorium, and Hochul declined to push any further legislation. Greenidge also caught another break from the state last year when DEC's permit denial was annulled, laying the groundwork for this agreement and permit renewal. Now, both the state and Greenidge will withdraw their appeals and discontinue the pending administrative hearing. Local climate advocates, however, slammed DEC's decision. They claim that Greenidge's facility has negatively impacted the region by increasing gas emissions, polluting water with thermal discharge, and contaminating groundwater used for the region's agriculture, especially in its wineries. Yvonne Taylor, co-founder and vice president of Seneca Lake Guardian, said, "Originally, they said it was only going to be operated as a peaker plant. It was only going to operate about 6% of the year and only do that to provide power to the public in times of high demand. Then, once they got up and running, they installed these Bitcoin mining machines, and the power being produced was not going to the public, but to fuel these machines. Along with that," she says, "they're raining down things like formaldehyde, mercury, lead, benzene onto our homes, our farms, and our vineyards. Those places are the region's lifeblood. Seneca Lake is also a drinking water source for over 100,000 people. Greenidge is allowed to withdraw up to 139 million gallons of water every single day and dump it in hot back into the lake, an area that we're already experiencing increasing harmful algae blooms, a toxin to humans and animals." Seneca Lake Guardian filed a lawsuit in 2023 to shut the Greenidge Generating Station. The suit was dismissed in federal court later that same year. So, of course, Seneca Lake Guardian is upset with Hochul's decision. Eric Wood, Senior Environmental Program Coordinator for the New York Public Interest Research Group, says, the governor has been ordered by the state's courts to follow the climate law, but her decision to approve permits for the Greenidge fracked gas power plant for a private crypto mining facility flouts that order. Taylor also levied criticism against Greenidge's impact on the local economy. She says it overemphasizes its impact on jobs in the local economy. In the past, the company has said that it created around 40 to 50 full-time jobs, with additional impact through electricians and other contracted work. Tourism in the Finger Lakes is our driving economy engine, Taylor outlines instead. It brings in $4 billion worth of revenue into New York State's economy every year and supports 60,000 jobs. For his part, Irwin says that the data center has brought high-tech jobs and opportunity to a region of New York that has been economically underserved for far too long. An evidentiary hearing for Greenidge's air permit renewal application has been scheduled for next week. That would be the week of the 17th of November. This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from contributing writer Jacob Schirmerhorn, and you're listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier radio readings. Our next story from the Rochester Beacon comes from writer Gary Craig, who is in a partnership between the Rochester Beacon and himself, featuring articles published on Gary Craig's Substack site. This article is dated November 12th. Rochester man jailed for terrorism alarms Kentucky prison staff. Mufid El-Ghi, a former Rochester pizza shop manager, now incarcerated for terrorism-related crimes, has prison officials so worried about his mental stability that they recently chose to fly him between prisons for safety reasons. Last week, El-Ghi, now accused of trying to kill a cellmate with a shiv, was flown from Kentucky to a federal facility in Houston, Texas, for a mental evaluation. Officials opted to fly El-Ghi instead of other transport means because his, quote, institutional behavior necessitated small aircraft transportation due to security concerns, unquote. No more details were available in court records, but El-Ghi's competency, his ability to follow and assist with his legal proceedings, will determine whether he will be tried. Court records show that he has claimed he has been treated inhumanely and wrongly placed in isolation while imprisoned. El-Ghi was scheduled for trial earlier this year on attempted murder charge. Attempts to reach El-Ghi's attorney this week were unsuccessful. El-Ghi's terrorism crimes. A decade ago, I, writes Gary Craig, wrote extensively of El-Ghi's address and terrorism-connected crimes. He pleaded guilty to recruiting fighters for the Islamic State and received what was then the longest sentence in the country for a crime of his type. El-Ghi, now 41, was sentenced to just over 22 years for providing material support to the Islamic State terrorist network. He's now scheduled for release just days before 2035, unless convicted on his current charges. He was the first American citizen accused of recruiting for ISIS, the militant Islamic State of Iraq, and the Levant jihadist organization, also called ISIL. When arrested, Elfge ran a pizza shop on North Clinton Avenue. As well as attempting to recruit soldiers for ISIS via 24 social media accounts, Elfge was also accused of plans to shoot returning American troops. He purchased 2 firearms, a silencer, and ammo from an informant working from the FBI. The guns were inoperable. Allegations of attempted murder. In January 2019, prosecutors allege Elfge assaulted his cellmate at the high-security prison in McCreary County, Kentucky. Both were incarcerated in a special housing unit. Court records say Elfge purportedly used a homemade shank to repeatedly stab the victim in the head, neck, and shoulders. Elfge was not immediately charged with a crime. As his attorney has said in court papers, the FBI initially decided not to investigate the alleged assault. Instead, he was disciplined internally. In court papers, a judge wrote, "The record does not explain why the prosecution arose after the initial FBI declination, but another 2 years passed before a federal grand jury indicted Elfge on the charge of attempted murder arising out of that altercation." There is a discrepancy here, perhaps explained in the voluminous court papers. Elfge was indicted in 2023, 4 years after the alleged assault. It's possible the grand jury indictment was not handed up until 2023. I wrote of the indictment for the Democrat and Chronicle. Elfge's mental state. Even when sentenced for his terrorism crimes, Elfge's mental stability was at question. U.S. District Judge Elizabeth Wolford said at his sentencing, "You have some significant mental health issues that I don't know that you've received treatment for." Elfge has already been deemed competent once since his 2023 indictment, but he has consistently warred with his lawyers. His latest is a replacement for earlier attorneys, and he has plastered the courts with his own handwritten motions and requests. His current state has prompted his lawyer, Patrick Nash, in Lexington, Kentucky, to request the competency exam be conducted in Houston. Nash wrote in a July filing that he and his investigator think, quote, "there is reasonable cause to believe that Mr. Elfge is presently suffering from a mental disease or defect, rendering him mentally incompetent to the extent that he cannot fully understand the proceeding and cannot meaningfully participate in the preparation of his defense." Nash filed a separate document under seal outlining specifics about why he questions Elfge's competency. Elfge, in court papers, is now expressing dissatisfaction with his lawyer. A federal judge in September ordered a new competency exam. Should Elfge be determined competent and go to trial, his attorney wants to keep his Rochester crimes out of the discussion. His lawyer wants a prohibition from questions to Elfge about the offenses should Elfge testify. Nash wrote in court papers, "The prejudicial impact will be significant. There are very few felonies that carry as many negative connotations as a felony involving terrorism." This story from the Rochester Beacon comes from contributing writer Gary Craig, who's a retired Democrat and Chronicle reporter who now writes on Substack and shares his stories with the Beacon. And you've been listening to readings from the Rochester Beacon on your Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. My name is Jan Heineman. Thanks for listening today, and I hope you have a chance to listen to the next Rochester area podcast.